All right, so let's take a look at the test, because this is what you have access to, but if you don't understand it, then it's not going to help you as much as it could. And it won't become the warning system that it should be. So number one, if interest rates go up, the following will likely happen to real estate prices in California. Prices will go up. Anybody have that? If interest rates go up, prices will go up. So we have some people agree with that. Prices will go down. We're going to have a lot of no answers. I can see that. Okay? Prices will stay flat. Any of the above could happen when interest rates go up. You guys, you just attended the seminar, so you know that. Is that important to know? It's really important to know, because when you listen to people that are in the public eye, they will tell you, well, wouldn't the no-brainer response would be, well, of course, when interest rates go up, real estate prices should go down. I mean, that's one of the problems. It actually makes a lot of sense, which is really important that when you have a history of prices in your head, and we didn't put a pricing chart here, but okay, I joined the party right here in 1980, but I bought a house here. By the time, this is what, 75? Interest rates were about 7.5, and by the time 1980, they were over 15. Interest rates doubled. So if you believe that prices are supposed to go down, you were disappointed because they tripled during that time. Now, we've had the greatest interest rates ever right here. And how have real estate prices responded, let's say, in 2010 and 11? They crashed. Lowest interest rates, if interest rates were vital, we should have had price increases the whole stinking time, basically. But oddly enough, if you know the future of interest rates, what can you absolutely tell me about the future of real estate prices in California? Nothing. It's only in that and how it affects another important chart. And you guys, this is the thing that you want to do, is you want to be independently capable of absolutely knowing you know that. Because an interest rate hike from 4% to 6, historically, is like, who cares? How long have you been below 6%? I mean, there's 6. Never here, ever. And all of a sudden, we think this is common. It's not. So if we went up to 6%, shouldn't be a price damage. That's not true if it happens at the wrong time. So that could be really damaging. Or if there's enough room in another chart, it could inspire people to buy because they don't want to miss out. So you could force volume and you could enforce price increases and you get to a magic number. So this is why it's important to understand this, okay? Number two. Got a lot of things to hold here. Number two, and I'll go to the chart. When houses are most affordable, what happens to volume of sales in California? So you can avoid houses. And the first answer, volume of sales increases as more people can afford them. Let me see your hands. Everybody's afraid. Volume of sales not affected by affordability. Okay, we've only had one answer so far. Volumes of sales declines because inventory is so low and affordability is high. Okay, sales decline when houses are most affordable. Most of you guys are no-shows, though. Okay, what's the right answer? Sales decline when houses are most affordable. This is affordability going up. Let's go back in history. This is why this is important. Affordability going up, it's a math combination, okay? Your prices usually go down when affordability goes up. That's part of the scenario. And when you lose prices, people are not excited about buying the next one. We have volume here because investors showed up, but when this affordability took off, our sales tanked. You couldn't give something away in 07. So when volume of sales went up here, I'm sorry, this is affordability, sales down. So when affordability goes up, it doesn't entice people to do something. It entices investors to buy and hold for cash flow, but the occupant buyer is not encouraged, okay? So sales decline when affordability is most affordable, okay? Third question. When houses are most affordable, where would real estate investors look for bargains? First answer, in the MLS. How many say that? Okay. Second one, following people that are in foreclosure. Okay. Mailing directly to absentee owners. And pursue lender-owned properties and short sales. Okay. So this is a very smart class, if you will. In the MLS is also obviously a good answer. The best answer is you would pursue lender-owned properties and short sales, and you would do that in the MLS. But that would be the target. Why would you not pursue people in foreclosure as affordability went up? Because you'd have that same scenario that I did in Grand Junction. I'd be talking to people, and they would all be sad, and they all upside down. And unless you want to do the short sale business, you get out of the way and let somebody else do that process, and you buy the end result after the negotiation, okay? What about mailing directly to absentee owners? It's the same thing. When absentee owners come off of a peak price, too, by the way, they still have that price in their head. So it's harder to negotiate. Like, if you do a mailer right after their peak, like 1989's a peak, you do a mailer in 1990, oh, boy, you got a tough crowd. You do that in, like, 95, they've been beat up for 4 or 5 years. They really know, yeah, real estate stinks, and I own some. And that's a better crowd to talk to. So that's important to know, or you can spend a lot of time wasted pursuing something that's not going to happen. Fourth one, when affordability is extremely low, what happens to construction of new homes? Sales of new homes decline sharply because they become unaffordable. Some people agree with that. Sales of new homes decline slightly. Sales of new homes are near their peak. Okay. By the way, is any of this counterintuitive? Most of it. That's why this is cool. If you understand this, what if you're a builder and you go, isn't it interesting? When prices get high and affordability gets low, what do I do if I'm a contractor? I build stuff until, guess what, it crashes. And I buy land at ridiculous prices so I can get ready to build some more. And that's why builders go boom and bust, because they don't understand when it's over. They have no warning system other than no one shows up. So what are the three things? You know, builders have those three reports that come out, and it's builder optimism, and those are never right. The optimism in 05 was exactly what it was in 89. It's wonderful. Why? Because everything is great. Traffic for our project is great. That's another one. Likely to sell, I think, is the other one. So the three charts that are about to get killed are wonderful until they're not. And then, unfortunately, as a builder, what have you got? You're holding a bunch of dirt that's completely worthless and goes down by 90%, and you can't get rid of it. So it's really important to understand, too, that stuff all of a sudden competes against what you've bought, and it's on sale. So when a builder has 50 homes in a tract, let's say, remember back in 2001, 2, and 3, and 4, we were buying new builds. It was really important to exit before the sale. Rosamond, we had a sale on 2 units. So our prices progressively went up. We started at 200. The last phase we had at 280. Now this is for a 1,200 square foot house on a 2,800 square foot lot in Rosamond, 280. Overnight sleeping, camping out, fist fights to get one of those babies. Two of them fell out, and we auctioned those off within 60 days because no one was showing up to any open houses, and it sold for 205. So in 60 days, whoever parked 280 grand in there was probably not very happy with us at 205, and Tony later bought something there at about 50 grand. Which really was a bummer for if you owed 250 on it, that's not really nice. Okay, that's how important timing is. But if we get involved in building, what some of us do, it's really important to know that at the very height of happiness, if all you have is how do I feel as a tool to judge what's next, you have a problem. Because you can't change your feeling quick enough to respond if you're a builder. You better understand that the chart says it's over. And I'm glad you guys are so happy that I can sell all my stuff. But to be honest with you, I'm now taking risk. Remember in that seminar we just had, we talk about being an investor or speculator? Most builders speculate way too long and give away all their stuff because they don't have access to anything that has to do with timing. And they're not in the mood to hear somebody say it either. John Burns, we've interviewed him a few times. He's a consultant for builders. And when he invited me back the second year in a row to debate about the California market, he was kind of one-on-one with me. He said, I can tell you as a consultant, if I said what you said, I would not have one customer. So he wouldn't be a building consultant because he was telling them bad things. So I guess the only way to be a building consultant is to say, yeah, things are great. And it's like, okay, that's what I wanted to hear so I can build some more stuff. One of my all-time favorite emails is about 2008. I get an email from John Burns. He says, okay, I think you're right. How bad is this going to get? You know, it was too late for his whole clientele, though. And it's because they didn't have access to something that said in a warning system, this is what's going to happen. Okay, number five. Looking at this foreclosure chart, what would be true about 1989? Trustee sales are very low, so it would be worthless to pursue foreclosures. Trustee sales are very low, so prices would probably be nearing their peak. Okay? Trustee sales are very low, so most of what you would buy is from the MLS. And trustee sales are very low, so it would be a good time to buy subject to. We didn't have a lot of participants in this one. Okay. The answer is trustee sales are very low, so prices would probably be nearing their peak. That's an important thing to realize because there's going to be a lot of things that change fairly quickly. If that peak price is true, then there's something called an inventory chart that's going to react very quickly. This foreclosure chart that we looked at is going to react very quickly. The mix of inventory changes very quickly. So if you were planning on exiting, this is sort of an additional chart to tell you, okay, we're approaching a time where foreclosure properties are such a small participant that the free will of the buyer that has what little is for sale can dictate the price. So you remember those years like 05 where you buy a house and you put flowers in and say, well, that'll be worth 50 grand because there wasn't anything else for sale. I mean, you got bonus for everything. To not to understand that it's about to come to an end is a problem. When the foreclosure chart is on its bottom, you also have the most euphoric buyer out there rationalizing, well, yeah, I'll buy Rosamond at 280, although it's 1,200 square feet and it's got a 2,800 square foot lot. So when you walk between the houses, your arm brushes against the window of the guy next door. Well, that's perfectly fine because I'd rather own one than rent. 90% of the buyers that bought in Rosamond worked in Los Angeles. That's the other rationalization, is I want to own something so bad, I'll drive 2 hours each way to do that. That's all about to change. When the chart changes and it goes in the other direction, do people make that aggressive decision for all of their lives to be consumed by owning something? No. That's why those distant areas get killed. Why Palmdale, Lancaster, Rosamond, Victorville, Adelanto, all those, like, do I want to drive to Orange County to work from Victorville? Not if the house is going to go down. Heck no. Will they resume that practice someday? See, probably. Because that's the part that charts don't really tell you, is the human being is a very interesting participant and will do the same thing over and over again. And then you go, okay, well, that makes this chart make a lot more sense. Okay. Interestingly enough, trustee sales, the very first answer, are very low, so it would be worthless to pursue foreclosures. Oddly enough, it's one of the good times to pursue foreclosures if you were in the buy-sell business. Because everyone that's in the foreclosure list has equity. Prices were so aggressive, that if you owned a house for a year, 1988 to 89, you had probably 25% equity. So you could pursue anybody on the list, and they had equity. Buy it subject to, sell it, be done. People usually do the opposite. When foreclosures are high, they go chase somebody in foreclosure, and that's the wrong time. All right, number six. Looking at foreclosure chart, what would a year like 1994 tell you? Trustee sales are still rising, so sales volume is probably up. Trustee sales are still rising, so it's a good time to mail directly to people in foreclosure. How many got that one? Some? Okay. Trustee sales are still rising, so it would be a good time to build new homes. That's what builders do. Okay. Trustee sales are rising, so I would expect prices to be soft. Okay. So if you understand that, then you start pursuing the right inventory. All of these charts start to tell a story in unison. And when we go through some of these charts, you'll see how they're connected. There's an initial chart, and there's a reactions by other charts. And if you can figure this out, where you literally can look at a chart and say, I know what to do tomorrow as an investor, absolutely, without fail, you know how far ahead you are from your competition? It's a very big deal. Okay. Looking at its affordability chart, what would a year like 1989 tell you about California real estate? We probably already know the answer is A and B. So it would tell you that you're approaching a price peak, and it would tell you that inventory is about to explode. And it would be telling you that exactly when you were emotionally so happy you participated in real estate. And it would be the easiest time to sell something that you have to somebody else. And without a chart, it would be impossible for you to make a decision to exit when you're so happy with what's happening. And that to me is why charts are important, because I can get emotional about stuff just like you. And to be able to avoid that damage on the upside and say I'm out, and also to be able to take advantage of a downside the same way. You remember how scary it was in 09? I mean, you got Lehman crashing and all that, and every website in the world's going, no, don't buy. It's going to get way worse. Well, you know, houses that were $350,000 in Moreno Valley could be bought for $60,000. It's going to get way worse than that. I mean, are we going to have like 2 for a quarter? Is that low enough? Since they rent for $1,200. Would that be a good investment? And remember the big question, will they ever build another one? So at some point, that was what Grand Junction taught me, to ask that question. Are they ever going to build another fourplex? If the answer is ever yes, then buying it for $40,000 is probably a good idea, because they ain't going to build one for $40,000. And so this information is very important, and to understand the sequence that happens if that one chart that's really important tips over, it's real important. Okay, which of these statements is most important? Affordability has declined from 55 to 30%, or affordability is at 30% with room to head down further. So how many think the 55 to 30 is the most important? You guys are such a tough audience, I don't know. Haven't we all heard that? Carr had a conference talking about affordability crisis already. I asked to get invited so I could sit on that panel. I really wanted to, because the damage they do to people unintentionally is very frustrating. You know, but at any rate, to me, it's the affordability at 30% with room to head down is much more important than the fact it went from 55 to 30. Is it less affordable? Yes. Are we in danger at 30% historically? No. And to me, that's the most important thing. All right. Looking at the inventory chart, where would you most likely find bargain properties in 87, 2003, and 2014? So 87. So what's the answer? We find them in the MLS? People in foreclosure? Lender-owned properties or going direct owners with mailers? Anybody know? Okay, you'd want to do direct mail. Your inventory's low. You know, it matches that your affordability's declined. Your foreclosures are low. Everything that hits the MLS gets attention. So now you're trying to kind of get an isolated group of people that know you're interested in buying who maybe want to avoid listing. There are people that literally have a phobia about listing a property. Have you ever experienced something like that? That is a very interesting. Like, I don't want no one coming in my house. I said, okay. I still own a rental in a gated area of Riverside. The guy went to church with me, and he came to me, says, I'm going to sell my house. I want to sell it to you. I said, okay. I said, why don't you just list it? Because you'll get more. It's a great house in a gated area. He said, I don't want anybody to go through my house. Well, I said, that does limit your options. I said, could I understand why that is? He says, well, I'm a narcotics agent, and I could have put some of these guys in jail that are going through my house, and they might be up to no good. I mean, he had pre-planned that his house was going to get visited by someone that was going to plant a grenade in there or something. Well, I can't undo that, but I can say, okay, I'll buy your house at a discount. And that's what happens sometimes. People don't want to go through that. And so, okay, so if you mail it to enough people, you get some share. Okay, so what was the question? Yeah, going directly to owners with mailers. How many of you in this room are doing that right now? I'm just curious. Seriously. Okay, there's less than 8 people. I'm just curious, how else are you buying properties? Or how many people are buying properties right now? Okay, the same 8 people. Okay, I sort of had to figure out who I was speaking to right there. How many people want to buy deals but haven't had luck finding them? Let's put it this way. Okay. All right. So they're usually not getting plucked out of the MLS right now. Charts tell us that was coming. And then we have to say, okay, we have to devise a strategy to take advantage of that. And that's what the education at the website is all about. Next question. What's the most important element of a mailer? First one, that makes the owner trust your motives. Second one, that you make an offer in the mailer. That you make, the third one, that you make a call to action statement. Sorry, that your mailer, it should say, that your mailer has a call to action statement, or that it gets opened. What's the answer? That it gets open? Okay. I mean, all the other stuff is important, but it's interesting. Where do you guys open your mail? Over the trash. Now, somebody put good money on that envelope, right? They got a buck in that envelope somewhere around there. And how long, because I'm sure you're considerate, you spend like a minute seeing if it's okay to open, right? It takes a half a second for you to know you're not going to open it. But guess what? They're going to mail 1,000 of those things and get the same response over and over again. One of the things we do in a boot camp is we literally have 10 envelopes that we have everyone look at, and we number them, and we say which are the 2 you would definitely throw away and which are the 2 you would definitely open. And 80 to 90% of the room does exactly the same thing. So if you're mailing something that always gets thrown out and everyone does it, it kind of says, don't do whatever this is. And so when you hold a mailer, you don't know why you're throwing it away. You've never gone through a mailer course and said, oh, this is probably something that I don't want to open, but you can tell. What are some of the things that you look at and go, I'm out of here? Pardon me? Bulk stamp, yeah. What about a label? So labels, bulk stamps. What are some of the things that get you, though? Like, I kind of have to open this. Handwritten? Yeah. Something in there. Like, I mean, you got to open it. Now, sometimes you get hoodwinked, you know. There was Charles Harris, a friend of mine. He got into this big time where he did a lot of mailers and bought a lot of properties. There was a two-month stretch that he bought nothing, and he was doing the lumpy mail campaign. And they had little hooks along with what you put in there. So he had, I still have it at the office, so I can show people the item. It was a silver platter. So he was mailing 1,000 silver platters a week out to people who had houses. And then the offer was, we'll basically pay cash and put it on a silver platter. Boy, that was cute. If you never got a phone call, there's probably 1,000 people wherever he's mailing going, I got this cute little platter, but he didn't get a phone call. So some of that cutesy stuff doesn't work, but some of the stuff that's subtle does. What's interesting is that this whole thing is changing. This is one thing that Aaron's going to be really a great participant in going forward, is how people communicate constantly changes. Okay, I was big on email, and I'd like send my granddaughter stuff, like here's a cute story and all that, and they would always respond. And then maybe there was a month I didn't do that, and then I did it again, no response. And I did it again, no response. It's like, oh, my granddaughter's a tick to me. No, they quit looking at email. They were into whatever was next. Was it Facebook? And all of a sudden you go, people aren't looking there anymore. Sometimes you could send an email message out and say, click on here and there's a $500, you know, and people blow through emails now or don't even pay attention to them because they've moved on. That's the thing about technology now. So when you're doing mailers, one of the things we do inside of a boot camp, because we have the chance, is we have 25 mailers that we look at sequentially. And we take a look at them and say, what's good about this? Because sometimes there's really good ideas in a bad mailer. They've done something right. And one of the things that we notice right is just what you've said. They give somebody choice. Rick Solis and Andrea have done that with having a choice to talk to either a man or a woman. That makes a difference. What about speaking Spanish or English? What if you realize that improves your response this much, but you do all those things right in a mailer? You not only get it open, but when you open it, you have everybody getting a chance to say yes, because your mailer covers all those things, email, Facebook, I don't know. I mean, in other words, that is smart, because people change constantly how they respond. So there's sometimes, I remember there was a guy in Riverside who had 50 people working for his company. At the time, he was doing the appropriate thing. He ran two ads in the Riverside Press paper, probably in five different places, and here's what his ad said. Thinking of selling? Call 1-800 blah 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 and listen to a recorded message. Thinking of buying? Listen to a recorded message. Is there any threat in a recorded message? So he got a lot of response, and what he literally did was build almost an off-site MLS supply of houses. Because if you were thinking of selling, he made an offer to buy it, but he also said, okay, I don't want your listing, but I do have people that come in and literally buy a list for $500 of secret homes. These are not in the MLS or available anywhere else. Now, is that basically a trial close too? I mean, if you get $500 from somebody to get access to your list, and the only way they can recoup $500 is what? Buy one of your houses. That's pretty slick. He needed 50 agents to do the volume he was doing, and he had his own little world off of two silly ads. And he had the right formula that you weren't forced to talk to anybody until you went through a filter and felt comfortable. Okay? That was smart. So that's what mailers do. And by the way, that's part of what's going to be in process at the website, is say, okay, this used to work. Now we hear this is working better. And that'll always be true in mailers. There'll always be something that's working better? What color paper works best? Anybody know? Like gold or yellow? Yeah. Why? Who cares? I mean, there's some stuff you don't have to analyze. Somebody spent $1 million or $10 million figuring this out. What color ink are you supposed to sign in? Blue. Why? It's a trust color. What's the odds you're going to figure all this stuff out on your own? Not very good. But if you're in the business of mailing 4,000 mailers a month, it's really good to get started on the right foot, where the odds are you're going to get the most calls back you can. There was a guy that took a boot camp within, I don't know, 6 months or so ago, a year. I have never heard of anybody mailing as many mailers as he did. Typical response for mailers, anybody that does it? I'm sorry, 2 or 3%. He was mailing upwards of 30,000 mailers a month. I'd never heard that kind of quantity, and his response was 0.25%. And he was making money. But 0.25%, and I said, my goodness, let me see the mailer. And he had a mailer that you would go and throw it out in an eighth of a second. And he still was getting 0.25% response, but you know how easy it was for him to go and bump that up by just changing a few things? He was trying to save money by bulk stamp and sticker and all that, and you just go, wow, you know, that's hurting you. You could mail a lot less and get a better response. So anyway, that's the kind of thing that we'll be able to play with and have access to, because one of the things we have is the loan business that tells us what's working in the marketplace. Like every month, we have a pile of yes answers that came from sellers. We can know who the sellers were. We can talk to the buyer and say, what was the deal? How did you access those people? And it builds a story that's very current every month. Okay. When you buy a property at a discount, what's the most common reason a seller says yes to your offer? They were desperate. They had no other choice. You were a great salesperson. Yeah, we're all going to take credit for a lot of that. Oh, Derek's hand involuntarily went up on that one. It's like, yeah, he's pretending he was stretching now. Or it was in their best interest.
I'm sure it's because I'm a great salesperson.
I know.
They didn't want to sell or even thinking about it, but I talked them into it.
There you go, just random door knock. Well, I mean, I guess I shouldn't put words in anybody's mouth. How many think it's because you're a great salesman? Does that apply? Yeah, it does apply. But I think most of the time it comes down to the last one. Somehow it was in their best interest. You can convince people to do stuff that's not in their best interest, but your business model would be much happier if you actually had a product that you could offer that was acceptable in some circumstances and it was in people's best interest. So all those things can happen. We've all had that phone call. I remember a phone call I made to a guy who was in foreclosure. The trustee sale was at noon the next day. And for whatever reason, I decided I'd call him at 10 at night the night before. I said, you got anything in the works that's going to solve your situation? He said, no. I said, you want me to drive out and we'll put a deal together? He said, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, literally, I drive out at 10:15 from Riverside out to Palm Springs, write up a deal on a foreclosure offer, and close it. Did you have to be a great salesman? Well, it helped, because he said to me, he says, I don't know why I'm telling you this. I haven't told anybody else this. So that means that I was trusted and I got it. But was he desperate? Yeah, he had no other choices? Yeah, all those things came into play. And at the end of the day, was it in his best interest to get what he could instead of lose it at sale? Yes. Okay. But most of our business is going to come about because we are giving somebody something that's in their best interest. Last question, when you buy a property at a discount, what's the most common reason a seller says yes to your offer?
Because
it solves a problem for them, and it's very interesting to see how repetitive it's the same problem. Going to lunch with Mike Cantu, I asked him a direct question. I said, I'm just curious, how often is a property that you buy occupied by a relative that's not paying? And he laughed, and he thought about it. I said, yeah, just think about it. I don't want the answer right away. And he actually said at least 40 to 50%. That's an astonishing number. But that's really good to know. So when you're talking to somebody, shouldn't you ask who's occupying the place? If they say, it's my brother's kid, the odds of you buying that house just went up. Because the next question is, well, how much rent are they paying you? And the answer is, zippity-doo-dah, and how long has that been going on? For a year and a half. I bought a house one time in Mira Loma on a mailer. House was worth $150,000. I bought it for $68,000. Literally taking over a loan with moving money, but the guy that owned it was a president of a company, didn't need a dime. The story was, who was in there? It was his son, who had lived there for 3 years with no rent, but the son had a grandson, so he couldn't evict his son because he wouldn't see his grandkid. So I was the solution, and what was the promise I had to make? I had to evict the son. He said, I'll do the deal, but you have to kick him out. You know, that was the deal. Because he was like, he was going to get that satisfaction through me and say goodbye to almost $100,000, but just to get that done was worth it. That happens. So to know that's important, okay? Again, this is a really big part of our business, you know, understanding why people do something. How many of you have ever sold a car to a company called CarMax? Anybody? Okay, a few of us. I'm going to do that every time I have a used car because it's simple. You drive the car up, somebody greets you, he makes happy with you while the appraiser goes out and says what your car's worth. They email him the offer. And 15 minutes later, you're done with the negotiation and they're cutting you a check. That's all we do. If you get good at understanding, that's all we do is we take selling property it's difficult to the easiest level possible. You come up in front of me with your inventory and leave with a check. If you understand that and understand there's some value to that, it's a big deal. How many of you guys have something that's pending in escrow right now? Okay, so less than 10% of you. To me, that's one of the most valuable things that you can have is actively participate in all these processes of repairing and selling and finding, because what happens is you realize that not every escrow gets to the finish line. Everyone promised it would, but there's barriers. What are some of the barriers? Oh, the appraisal came in $3,000 light. Can you believe that? You're selling a house for $270,000, and some appraiser comes in at $267,000 and justifies his existence in the world. And you want to choke him, right? It's like, what? They're so happy they're buying a new house, they buy a new car during escrow. The wife loses her job. On and on. When you don't sell properties for a living, you think it's, well, this is going to be, I'll sell it myself. I don't need you to write a check for it. And then see, that's what happens when you have experience. You bring that to the table and say, how long has it been since you've sold a house? Here's a stack of paper that's going to be required. Is it about an inch thick now? Do you understand what any of these pages mean? Because if you don't, you have liability all over the place. You think you're going to sell it without the MLS? Here's a chart that says 98% of everything that's sold is in the MLS. So you're going to be dealing with 2% of the buyers. And what are they going to be looking for? A deal. And you're going to be without any filter whether they can close or not. Oh, and then they, like, the needs repairs. Well, I can get it painted for $500. Have you seen a $500 paint job? Yeah. Did it make the house sell? No. When you're in the business, you realize, okay, what you're about to take on, you are completely incapable of doing. That's the truth. You think you can get it sold, and you think you can repair it, and what's going to happen sometimes is you're going to hire a contractor who's going to get a deposit because you don't know any better, and you don't have relationships. So you're going to write $5,000 that's going to finish his last job, and before he starts your job, he's going to need a $5,000 check from someone else to start yours. And then he's going to come here, and you don't have any contacts, so you're going to say, you know, what are you good at? And what's the answer? Everything. I'm good at everything. And are they good at everything? No. They might be good at nothing if they say that. And then it's your joy to walk through what was supposed to take 3 weeks. It takes 3 months, and then they disappear after they torn your stuff out. Oh, you vacated the house while that was in escrow? Is your house insured? No. Have you ever had somebody move in your house? I have. That really happens. Does that sound like I'm closing somebody? But am I taking advantage of them? No, I'm giving them a warning. You think this is an easy journey to a yes answer? I'm in escrow with, say, 15 properties every day of the year, and they all don't close. But I'll tell you what, none of them closes without me knowing about a list that has to get solved. I have never in my entire life just got a phone call, and they said, you know that property on Pine Street? It closed. Really? Went through everything, and I no one needed anything from me? Amazing. That doesn't happen. And see, unless you are a participant, you don't know that. And you become less able to say, you know what? That's why getting a check is really a good idea. How did you get this house? Oh, it was deeded to me in a will. So your cost basis is zero. And you live where? Minnesota. Well, I can understand why you don't want to be in Minnesota right now. But it doesn't mean you understand California real estate. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what this whole process is saying we have a service. You drive your asset up to us, we write a check, and there's people in this room that become very wealthy because they knew how to get a yes answer. And they also had charts and understood them, that they understood their business model changed radically when charts said different things. And so that's why, to me, this education system we've put together and the fact that it has such flexibility now is pretty cool.